Thank you. I want to first mention that I have actually a fairly bad ear infection, and so my hearing is actually almost completely shot. So if anyone has any questions, please just scream out very loud, throw things at me, something soft, no chairs, please. So what I'm going to talk about are quantum adiabatic computing and some of the problems that we've been looking at with trying to solve NP-type problems. So this work is a collaboration with D-Wave Systems, particularly Bill McGee. Okay, so the main problem on quantum, I'm going to use the term quantum annealing and quantum adiabatic computing interchangeably, although they're not really quite the same thing. But our main objective is just to go from the initial state to the initial ground state to the ground state of the final Hamiltonian as fast as possible. And you want to have some control in your system to be able to tune the Hamiltonian to go from H0 to H1 in an optimal way, meaning as fast as possible, but still have good fidelity to remain in the ground state. So one example you can apply this to in a naive way would be for the factoring. And one way you can do this for factoring would be simply to make your Hamiltonian be that right there, if you want to factor the number n into a product x, y. And you can have your x and y be made out of your spins, basically the binary representation of your two products. And that Hamiltonian are written it that way. So the ground state is when the Hamiltonian has energy zero, and that is when x and y are just the factors. And n here is the number that you want to factor. So there are some issues with this. This approach will work. And in fact, there has been a recent paper showing that this works for factoring 15. In an adiabatic way. The problem for scaling this is that if you see here, you require four-body interactions, which are very difficult to produce in a solid-state environment. You also need high connectivity, meaning each qubit has to be connected to many other qubits in your system. And also, your coupling parameters have exponential range because they're the base two representation of your number. And typically, experimentally, you have a finite range of what these parameters could be. What this means, you have to have very high precision how you fix your coupling constants. So our first task was to try to find out some way that we can do better than this. So here's an outline of basically what I'm going to talk is an approach to solving these NP-type problems using quantum annealing and apply it to the integer factorization. So it's very different than the Shor algorithm. And an approach to improving the efficacy of quantum annealing by controlling how you actually evolve from the initial Hamiltonian to the final Hamiltonian. And the implementation of D-Wave, I wasn't involved in the experiments, but if there's time, I'll give you a little overview of what it is they're doing. So what are the common features of NP problems? Okay, the important part that all of them share in common is that the verifying a solution is very simple, right? Multiplication is simple, factoring is hard. And typically, the verification circuits are polynomial in size. If you think of a multiplication circuit, it grows quadratically with the inputs. And typically, the circuits are very simple to do, and often the connectivity between the individual components are a very small number of coupling constants you need. So since we're not doing a gate model here, we're not going to actually do the computation in the traditional kind of von Neumann machine sense. We thought to see if we could try to leverage the verification circuits to find the solutions. So in a sense, what we want to do is inverse verification here. And so what we want to do is build the classical verification circuits and transform it into an optimization circuit. And the reason why you want to do that is logic circuits are feed forward. There's definitely a direction of time. But the optimization circuits are not. They're in a sense omnidirectional. They can go in different ways, or probably a-directional is probably a better description. And so we can try to run it in a sense backwards. And since factoring is inverse multiplication, can we do the multiplication and see if we can run the circuit backwards to do the factoring? That's the general idea. I'll share how this works for factoring. So we want to start with the problem and compile it down to a Hamiltonian. This is compilation is a kind of a translation from one language to another language. So you can think of this as being a form of compilation. And we do it with three steps, and I'm going to use factoring as an example. So step one will be just to write a regular old classical multiplication circuit that you would do in a second year engineering class using adders, half adders, and AND gates, and so forth. That circuit will grow quadratically. You translate that circuit into an optimization circuit, and then that optimization circuit you translate to a Hamiltonian whose ground state is the solves the optimization problem. So here's an example of step one for doing it for a multiplication. So here I wrote down the sort of a, you know, the grade school way of multiplication here. And you can build that circuit by using these three gates, an AND gate, a half adder, and a full adder. These are just regular old classical logic gates. So for example, you can see the logic of that first least significant bit. It has the logic of an AND gate. P0, the product can be 1 only if A0 and B0 are themselves 1 and 0 otherwise. So that's basically an AND gate. The next column over, that has similar logic, except now you need two outputs. You have two inputs, but you need an output because you have a carry bit, which you take over to the other one. This is now just a standard half adder circuit. And so since it's a sum, you see P1 can be 1 if the two input states are either one of them is 1 or if they're both 1. And if they're both 1, you output a 1 and you have an extra carry bit. And the other circuit is now a full adder. It's a very similar thing. Again, you have two outputs, one for the product and one for the carry bit. And now you have three input states and so on. And with these three gates, you can write down the whole multiplication circuit. That's basically, I'm not going to write down the logic circuit. I'm just going to write down these three gates. Then step two is you want to translate the circuit into an optimization circuit. And that's also fairly simple to do. Although if you add in the experimental constraints, it becomes a little more difficult. But basically, you want to write down, if you think of this as being a 3-bit problem, you want to write down an energy function that takes 3 bits of input. And I wrote it down this way, and because there's only 8 possible input states to this function, you can enumerate them all, and the ones that highlighted are the ground state. I wrote this energy in this way for two reasons. One reason is that there's only quadratic terms there, so it's only two-body interactions we'll need eventually. And the ground state has the logic of the AND gate. And so if you look at the ground state of that energy, it's fourfold degenerate, and it's fourfold degenerate that has all these states. So the ground state here has the logic of the AND gate. And you do this now for all the gates in your circuit, and you add them all together. And you end up with something like this. And so if you look at this system now, this is the original logic circuit translated into an optimization circuit. The yellow little boxes here are AND gate or the optimization analogs of the AND gates. The green ones are the half adders, and the red ones are the full adders. And so each of those little boxes is a little constraint. You write down a little energy function just the way I did for the relevant input states. You add them all together, and you end up with some big energy function that depends on things like the input bits, one factor and another factor, and the product bits, and also all the internal bits, the partial sums and the carry bits and so forth. And so this is what I mean by adirectional. This is just the energy. So the ground state of this system are all those states that have the logic of multiplication. So you can use this now to do factoring. So for example, if you want to factor these two, if you want to factor this number here, what you want to do is just clamp the bits corresponding to the product states. You clamp them to be the product bits. And now you ask, what's the ground state of this energy? And the ground state of that energy is going to be the ones where, since this, the ground state subspace has the logic of multiplication, the ground state of this one will be such that these two bits are the products. And so that's how you do factoring. And so now we want to translate it into a machine-readable form. Well, that's pretty trivial to do, at least it's trivial to write down. You basically take all these bits, you convert them to spins, and you have this Hamiltonian here. This Hamiltonian is not, you cannot do universal adiabatic quantum computing with this Hamiltonian. It's a limited set, but you can solve decision problems with it. So these spin operators are all FZ operators. So this is diagonal. Okay, and this approach can be generalized to arbitrary, so this arbitrary piece of classical code can be embedded in this way and transformed to a problem maybe about a quantum computing. And any type of decision problem can also be done this way. And the circuit will grow quadratically. So how do we want to solve this now? So again, we want to, that's part one of an approach to solving NP type problems. The second part would be how do you go from H0 to H1 in an optimal way? And optimal in this case means as fast as possible, but still remaining a high probability of ending up in the ground state of your final Hamiltonian. So there's many ways to do this. One way is to have a one parameter, which is what most of the people do. And that S now is just your time parameter. The normalized time just goes from 0 to 1. And if you have this one parameter here, you see you go linearly from H0 to H1 as your time evolves from 0 to 1. And this is what most people use. It's a conventional way to do. And I'm going to show, and it's pretty easy to see, though, why this is probably the worst thing you can do in terms of performance. And it's pretty easy to see why this is. I'll tell you, I'll explain it in a few more slides. Now you can generalize this. You can do much better, for example, if you just not make it linear, but just make it some arbitrary function that has the appropriate boundary conditions, boundary and time. And you can generalize it still even more, and you don't need even to have the same functions. You can have two different functions as long as they satisfy the two endpoints at s equals 0 and s equals 1, you're fine. So you can basically go full out and think of all those couplings, the q's, the b's, and the j's as themselves being time-dependent parameters. As long as they satisfy the appropriate boundary conditions, you have now an n squared parameter space. And so it's a huge space to explore from going from initial to final Hamiltonian. And in fact, I think the problem in adiabatic quantum computing is in fact the problem of finding proper trajectories, not so much of finding the gaps. And that's fine, it's hard to find because you have an n-dimensional subspace. That you have 2 points, the initial and final Hamiltonians, you want to find the best way to go from one point, from one Hamiltonian to the other Hamiltonian. So it's a pathfinding problem. So this has been noticed by some people, notably Dan and Ali, Dan Lidar and Reza Khani, developed this differential geometric approach that we've been following some time, although we're not doing it this way now. But because the unknowns are functions, you can try to phrase in terms of a problem in calculus of variation. So they wrote down this local adiabaticity condition, which is a kind of heuristic for the true adiabatic condition. And now you want to basically find the functions xi of time, which minimize t. You can change the results, the results they came up with slightly to derive this Euler Lagrange operator whose trace should vanish. And if you go through, I won't go through all these details, you end up with a series of coupled partial differential equations. And the solution to these should be a much better annealing trajectory than just a linear trajectory. So if we apply it to factoring and using just one parameter, if you go to our specific Hamiltonian, you have only one differential equation that you have to solve, and it's that one. And so what we try to do with this case is just solve this differential equation and compare the solution we get to the linear solution. When I compare the solution, what I mean is do a multiple, well, maybe I'll just go over and tell you what our procedure is. So what the procedure we did was write down all these factoring problems here for all of these. Actually, we've done quite a bit more now. For each one of those, write down the circuit, like I said in step one, to have your final Hamiltonian. And when you have that final Hamiltonian, solve these Euler-Lagrange equations to find the optimal trajectory for each one of those. And then when you do that, then you solve Schrödinger's equation to evolve the system forward in time, because remember that adiabaticity condition that we used to derive these optimal trajectories actually wasn't the adiabatic condition, it was just a heuristic. So you have to solve Schrödinger equation. We wanted to see with a fidelity of 0.9, how long does it take to get to reach a fidelity of 0.9. And then we wanted to plot it to check how that compares to the linear trajectory. Okay, we plot the scaling, not to do the asymptotics, but to see how much better linear versus this optimal trajectory can do. And so typically the trajectories that you do look something like this. So the linear trajectory, here I'm plotting the parameter, which should vary from 0 to 1, which you use your tuning knot to go from your initial to your final Hamiltonian, as a function of normalized time, 0 to 1. So the linear one is the green one, but the optimal trajectory goes something like this. I think this one is for factoring 49, but generically they all look that way. And you can kind of see why they should all look this way, and you can also see why it should always be better than the linear case. The reason is that the limiting case here is the size of the gap. The gap meaning the difference in energy between the ground state and the first excited state. You start off with initial Hamiltonian, you know that spectrum. You have the final Hamiltonian, you know that spectrum. You calculate the gap at the endpoints. And typically what happens as you look at it through the whole annealing procedure is the gap actually closes in the intermediate times and opens up again. It closes not to zero, but has some minimal value in the middle. So what you want to do, the time scale at which you can evolve actually scales as 1 over the gap squared, actually. So the smaller the gap, the longer you have to go. So what you really want to do is, when the gap is large, you want to move fast with high velocity. When the gap is small, you want to slow down. And then when the gap increases towards the end, you want to speed up again. But if you're going linearly, you can't do that. Linearly means you're going at a constant velocity. So whatever the smallest gap is, you have to go, that sets your velocity, and you're stuck doing that throughout the whole annealing process. And so you see why the shape should be something like this, because you know, you go fast here, high slope, initially when the gaps are large. When the gap goes small, you want to slow down, so the velocity here, the slope is very small, and then when the gaps open up again, you go large again. And so here are the kind of differences you can get from going doing a linear. So here I'm plotting the annealing time versus the fidelity, or 1 minus the fidelity, so 0 is best here. And if you do it, this is again for factoring 49. If you want a fidelity of 90%, that's 0.1 on the vertical axis here. If you do it with the optimal way, you can do quite better. Actually, right now, we can also do much better right now, because this is only using a 1-parameter annealing function. If you use more, you could actually do much better than this. In fact, what we found now is you don't even need to solve those differential equations, because all trajectories kind of look like this. We also know that it's better to start off with 0 velocity, and then speed up, start coming with 0 slope and end at 0 slope. So you can even do better than this by forgetting about that local adiabaticity condition, forgetting about solving the Euler-Lagrange equations, just writing down an analytical function that looks like this. This sigmoidal shape, which is kind of like an arctan function, and fiddling around with the analytic form to get it to have 0 derivatives initially at the initial and final state, and that has some kind of constants in there. And just by playing around with those constants, you can actually do much better than this. And if you have 2 or 3 parameter scaling, they all basically look the same. They look the same thing. So it actually ends up being a much simpler problem. So what we did now, we did that for all those factoring problems that I showed you. We did it for all those. So here I'm plotting on the x-axis is the number of bits in the product. So we went up to 6 bits. We can do more. The reason why we're only going up to 6 bits now is because this is 17 spins to implement a 6 bits. And we're just doing exact diagonalization here. And that's because we didn't think this would work when we first started it. Now that it does work, we're going to move into quantum Monte Carlo to be able to have larger numbers in this product. But what we did for each of those products, we basically calculated the annealing time, and then we plotted and we fitted the worst case for this is for the optimal trajectory for each of these bits. And if you fit this, it actually fits to a power law, not to an exponential. The exponent is about a cubic that has the best fit. If you do it for the linear trajectory, it looks something like this, and this actually fits more like an exponential than a power law. And so, even doing this little bit of changing your annealing trajectory from linear to this sigmoidal sort of shape can make a huge difference in even in how your system behaves and the performance of your system. So that's basically the story for the theory. How much time do I have left? Sorry, I can't.
Yeah,
I should wrap it up. Okay.
There's one more glitch here in embedding the problem. So this is the qubit, the chip that D-Wave has. I'm not going to go into the experimental details of how they do this. They recently published a Nature paper showing how it all works for the 8-qubit system. But this is the connectivity they have on the chip. And this is the connectivity between the bits you need for factoring. Again, I think this is for 49. And the connectivity looks quite different. So what you have to do is take this graph
and try to embed it on this graph. It's a graph embedding problem, which is a different but difficult but also very interesting problem. So what we can do there is slave these qubits. And so here's the system they have. Not all the qubits are working, so all these empty spaces here are bits that aren't actually working. And so what you do to solve this embedding problem is you have to slave some of the qubits. So if you look here, for example, these light blue ones, you see this one is connected to that one, that's connected to that one, that's connected to that one. And those are all coupled ferromagnetically. And the reason why you do that is you want this qubit to be coupled to that qubit, but there's no direct connection in the hardware. And so you have a path to go between those two qubits, and all those links, you couple them ferromagnetically. And so you use all the qubits, but even though the problem is only 17 spins, you really need to have something more like 70 qubits to actually implement it. And these, this will be the last slide. These are the kind of results that they get. And what I'm plotting here is the probability of being in the ground state as a function of, and it's just kind of histogram of doing multiple runs to get statistics. And what they can find, this is for factoring 65, they get a fidelity of about 12 or 13%. And this is just using a linear trajectory. We're working on using these sigmoidal trajectories now to see if this can improve at all. The issue why we think this probability is so low, although we always see the ground state and we always know that we have the ground state, is the fact that in experiments, when they fix a value, there's some spread, they actually get some, there's some noise. So when you want to realize H or J, you actually get some H plus some delta, and delta is typically Gaussian distributed. So the Hamiltonian that's implemented may not be the Hamiltonian that you thought is implemented, and so the ground state may not be what you thought it was. And that is what brings the probabilities down. Okay, I think I'll stop there.